So that was a pretty heady day of Vipassana and the great perfection. And so let's chill out and just relax and leave the taste of the great perfection that Yangtang Rinpoche gave to us. Just leave that as in our mouths and not tamper with that. So let's go back to the body with breath meditation. So find your comfortable position. Begin by settling the body in its natural state. This may have a different meaning for you now. Realizing the degrees of relaxation that are possible and required for some of the meditations that you've been doing. So bring that fine degree of relaxation, the acuity that you developed now that can detect more subtle constrictions, tensions, recognize and release them on the exhalation. The practice that we'll be doing is asanas, mindfulness of breathing. And asanga instructs us to also recognize fluctuations of prana, that these are experienced in the body. And a turbulent mind rides on turbulent winds. So while you are scanning the body for tension and constriction, notice energy. Agitation in the most extreme times, it might seem like a frenzy. But aid your relaxation by releasing turbulent energy on the exhalation. Calm and soothe the pranic system. And with the release of turbulence and the release of tension, you have a much better chance of discovering the effortless silence of the mind, or I'm sorry, of the speech, settled in its natural state. And on the basis of deep relaxation and silence, settle the mind in its natural state by being content with the present moment. Whatever is going on right now, rather than going off to the future or the past, thinking of what has been or what will be, all of those are conceptualizations. But you now are so familiar with this natural state of the mind, spacious, still awareness, that illuminates appearances, but it doesn't become them. It remains still as it illuminates motion. Allow this still, spacious awareness now to illuminate the space of the body. Meaning that only the five senses are illuminated. Those doors are open. And first of all, with intention, limit the illuminating power of your awareness to only the domain of sound. This is one of the six primary consciousnesses. So know sound as sound, rather than as conceptually elaborated sound. As the Buddha told Bahia, in the herd, there is only the herd. And notice, to the degree that you are able to limit the illuminating power of your awareness to only this one sense field, your awareness does remain in the present moment. If thoughts bubble up, which they are likely to do, recall your strategy, the advice of Yangtang Rinpoche for maintaining shamatha without a sign. Note them so that they can't abduct you. Note them as soon as they arise, and they will dissolve. You'll puncture the bubble. The thief withdraws. And now, with intention, shift the illuminating awareness to the domain of tactile sensations. And maintain that same naked awareness that you had with sound. It can be a little more challenging to notice tactile sensations as only tactile sensations without elaborating them as my sensations, my pain, my pleasure, my bliss, my body. But bring that spacious, still awareness to illuminate only tactile sensations. Wherever they occur in the body, and now with intention, direct the illuminating awareness to only those tactile sensations that change as the breath enters and leaves your body. Wherever these occur, give up all control of the breath without your preferring that it be one way rather than another. Just let the body breathe itself and discover this breath. It's as if the entire space of the body is aware. And so the places where you feel and experience these tactile sensations of the breath may be very surprising. Just open, receptive awareness, knowing the present moment as tactile sensation of the breath. And engage these tactile sensations of the breath through the full course of the exhalation, where you'll find a pause before the inhalation commences, where you'll find a pause before the start of the exhalation. Follow that full course of the exhalation. Wherever these tactile sensations announce themselves, use the power of intention and introspection to promote stability. You can recollect your instant wordless intention at the pause after the inhalation, and add a moment of introspection at the pause after the exhalation, without breaking your engagement with the sensations of the breath in either place. If your still awareness has been set in motion and gone wandering to the future or the past, but it's only a brief time, you can patch the gap and just go right back to the tactile sensations. But if your awareness has been wandering for a long enough time that you've completely forgotten what you're doing, reset with the four R's. Release, rejoice, return, and relax ever more deeply all the way through the full course of the exhalation. So, a few questions, and I'm sorry that already this is our last night to do this. Boy, that happened, went really fast. So, from my vantage point, in Nirvana, would I be wrong to be somewhat entertained by the chaos of samsara? Oh, yeah, so it is. From my vantage point in Nirvana, would I be wrong to be somewhat entertained by the chaos of samsara? I think so. His Holiness says, that when you get a taste of nirvana, your compassion explodes. So, you know, entertainment, you know, I think there, you know, delight, joy, bliss, all of those things, but it wouldn't be because of samsara and the folly of samsara. I think the folly of samsara is going to inspire compassion, because you realize that all this suffering is needless. You know, it's not inherent, it's not in the circumstances, it's not because of, you know, the seasons or where you live or whatever. You know, it's not a natural disaster, it's not because your child died or whatever, you know. It's because we're fundamentally deluded. And when you get the taste of nirvana, you realize that it's possible, and not only for you, but for everyone else. So I think that it is compassion rather than entertainment that would be the natural reaction of someone who has even tasted nirvana. I used to think it is a substitute, I used to think of it as substrate is to substrate consciousness, as Dharma Dhatu is to Dharmakaya. Yep, that's right. We seem to have released the term Dharma Dhatu and are using only Dharmakaya. So Dharmakaya is ultimate ground and that which spontaneously actualizes. Yeah, it's a little confusing because of the non-duality. So Lama Ellet has pointed out that in the same text, Dujam Lingpa will be referring to, here this person is absolutely right. So we're talking about substrate consciousness and substrate. So the substrate is the ground, and in this case, the unaware aspect of the ground, and then the consciousness is substrate consciousness. And then bump those up to across the threshold into the pure ground, and then you have pristine awareness, and then Lama Ellen used to say was Dharma Dhatu. So Dharma Dhatu then was emptiness, was space, and Dharma Dhatu is the absolute space of phenomena. And then Dujam Lingpa, perhaps because of just to illustrate the non-duality, really changes up the terms. And talks about Dharmakaya as emptiness, as space, etc. And then, so for instance, in Vajra Essence, the citation was the unaware aspect of the ground is substrate, and the pure aspect of the ground is Dharmakaya. Other settings, it would have been Dharma Dhatu. So. This questioner is right to be a little confused about that. So basically, I think if there needs to be consistency, you know, I think that the most consistent way that I'm thinking about it is the way that Yangtang Rinpoche described it. So the emptiness element, basically, just the whole emptiness of pristine awareness is Dharmakaya. And then it's probably easiest just to think about the three bodies of the Buddha, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya, and then just think of absolute space of phenomena as the ground. And, you know, if you need, you know, and if you, if it's called Dharma Dhatu, you know what we're talking about, or what Dujom Lingpa is talking about. But there really doesn't seem to be any consistency or any concern about consistency in that. What are your thoughts on why the lamas are always reincarnated as men? Well, they're not, but most have been. And I think that is because, you know, Tibetan society was patriarchal, and there were definitely more and better funded monasteries than nunneries, and it's still the case in Tibet. But boy, these Western women are showing them what it's like in the Tibetan world now. Go to Tenzin Palmo's nunnery, and that is the envy of a lot of monasteries. It is just beautiful and well-run, and wow.
How far is she from you?
About an hour. Yeah, so it's not in Dharamsala. It's to the east, along a winding road, but in just beautiful, beautiful setting. And the architecture and the art in it is staggering. It's really one of the most beautiful gampas I've ever seen. And it's all women in the gampa. All the murals on the walls are all women. And what it points out, and I think the intention is to point out, is that there are a lot of accomplished women in the tradition. And, you know, that's what they're doing, is raising the consciousness. What the Western women are bringing to the Tibetan tradition is, you know, this equality. And, you know, the Tibetan hierarchy seems to be very, very comfortable, and His Holiness is very comfortable and supportive in endorsing that. So, yeah. So, Tosam Ling. So that it was created as a nunnery for Western nuns, and Tenzin Palmo is for Tibetan, Nepali, Bhutanese nuns rather than Western nuns. I don't think she's the only Westerner there, but almost all of the nuns there are. And they, you know, they really focus on Tibetan language and all. But yeah, the place that I was at was really beautiful also, but not quite on that scale, not as well, nearly as well funded as Tenzin Palmo's. So yeah, I think it's just a cultural thing, and that is definitely changing. And you see it, you know, just the change, I think, in the last, well, since the 1970s, a lot of the great Western teachers, you know, who really become, you know, very close to their lamas, study with their lamas, and then become great teachers are women. You know, so out there on the circuit, there just are a lot of great Western women teachers. So, you know, why do they choose to reincarnate as men? You know, who knows whether they have, but they were just, you know, the ones that are men got recognized. Maybe that was it. That I think is definitely changing. And then you have women like Khandra La, and she's like the Dalai Lama. You know, not with the secular power of the Dalai Lama, but she, you know, the reverence with which people hold her, I think, and the aura around her is kind of, you know, very much like that, I think. So this one I've already done, okay. So, yeah, things are really different these days, and there just are, for nuns, you know, it's still not the greatest situation for Tibetans, you know, for practitioners and teachers and all of that, we're, you know, really, it's amazing, and I think that women really appreciate that. You know, I've heard that from women, that they appreciate hearing a feminine voice. And men at Tosam Leng also, we had, out of 32 people, we had maybe 7 men or so. They had fewer accommodations for men that they had opened up in the registration. And the men, it was interesting reporting that they really liked being in the feminine energy of Tosam Leng. How does one convince one's mind to a... How does one convince one's mind to a how it is to be refuted? How does one convince one's mind to a to know it to be refuted? Is it by it, the mind, the self, thirsting for release from samsara? Ah, so I think we get the general gist anyway, even if I am not able to quite read it. So how does one convince one's mind? How do you inspire your mind? How do you motivate your mind to practice? So to be refuted, I think basically to break our habits of delusion is kind of the way I'm reading into this. So how do you inspire the mind to see through its own delusion? Is it by thirsting for release from samsara? But that presupposes knowledge or awareness that there is something beyond samsara. So do all sentient beings have some glimpse of this knowledge? I wouldn't say all sentient beings have the glimpse of the knowledge, but that the pristine awareness is there. So all sentient beings possess this, but it's said that, so among all sentient beings, humans are really especially well equipped and maybe uniquely equipped in order to really perceive the full range of our potential. So you wouldn't say that a lot of animals, or, you know, in Tibetan frame of reference, so Tibetans and lower forms of life don't have the cognitive capacity that we do in order to understand and to really contact and take advantage of that. That's why this is a precious human rebirth. We have unique attributes. And then in Tantra, it's said that there are other elements of the human body that make it possible for us to become enlightened. So do all beings have a glimpse of their potential? I'm not sure of that, but, you know, I wouldn't discount it because of, you know, they're just all the information coming in about the power of animals to conceptualize just keeps, you know, kind of blowing all the old assumptions out of the water. But so we could just ask ourselves, you know, focus on ourselves. How is it then that we have these intuitions? What is it that propels us or inspires us to cut through the delusion that has been our habitual perceptual pattern for so long? So I think there are two approaches or two ways that this could happen. One you could say is the push and the other is the pull. So Geshe Michael Roach used to say all of his great students, all of his best students, had a great tragedy in their lives. And I really felt left out by that. Because I had not had a great tragedy in my life. So that's one possibility. So you have a great tragedy in your life and you become disillusioned. So the Nyenjung always includes these two elements, doesn't it? So there's the disillusionment with the way things are. And then in coaching, doing the life coaching that I used to do, Always had this saying that you basically, at some point, the pain of doing the same is going to overwhelm the fear of the unknown, or the fear of doing something different. And so at some point you reach that disillusionment with the way things are. And so that can do it, and it can be tragedy. You know, so, and then you just start looking for answers, because when you have a tragedy, you know, someone in your family dies, or you have, you know, illness or whatever, you know, any tragedy can really force a reevaluation of your life, your assumptions, your priorities, all of that. And so that's one way. And so you might just then start looking for answers, you know, and I would guess that when tragedy strikes, what you're looking for is something with meaning and purpose, explanatory power about the role of you in the universe, it's all that stuff. So it could be that your seeking is propelled, you're pushed by tragedy or pain, than to find an answer. So I think that would be a natural way to do it. And then the other way is what I think of as I used to call this the soft path to renunciation, or this is the pull. And so this would be where you have one of these glimpses. You know, so I had one of these glimpses when I was 18 years old, and it did change. It was a peak experience, and it just changed my life 180 degrees. You know, all of my priorities, everything I was studying in college, all of it totally reoriented. And so people have that. You know, you have something just spontaneously happens to you. You know, and there are explanations for that within our Buddhist worldview. But so something happens to you, and it's not a tragedy, it's a good thing. And that is the pull, so that's the attractant. Then you figure out, well, what was that? How do I explain that? How do I stabilize in that? How do I get more of that? Because that was everything. That's all I want in my life, is that, is more of that, and stabilize in that. So that's the other way, I think. So there are these two ways, I think, or two possibilities. You get pushed or you get pulled. Yeah, I'll include that in my memoir.
White mama too.
Is this accurate? Because there's still, you know, real autobiography to get to here. Is this accurate? All is mind, mind is emptiness, emptiness is Dharmakaya, spontaneously actualizing and self-releasing. Yeah. So all is mind. So we went through in our Vipassana primer, we went through a number of sources that said that, right? So that is the whole point. All phenomena are produced by mind. And you get that, basically reduce that to all appearance is mind. So yeah, I think you can say that. That doesn't mean, you know, with the asterisk, that this means that the only thing in existence is mind, and that there is no matter or no physical world or something like that. You know, and this is really important to keep in mind, because that, you know, if all is mind and you don't add that asterisk, then that can just lead you to solipsism or nihilism. You know, what difference does it make, you know, whether the earth is overheating or not, and that species are disappearing at a rate not seen since the extinction of the dinosaurs. So what does that matter? It's all mind anyway, right? So my mind is resting in nirvana. So it doesn't mean that there isn't a physical world that is produced by, and that there are physical laws governing the operation of a physical world. And that world operates according to laws of natural causality. This is what the Buddha discovered, was natural causality. Causes and conditions produce all phenomena. But the interesting thing then is to question this appearance right now that I have of that physical world. Does that exist in the physical world? This appearance of the thing, you know, and it's the appearance that we take to be the thing, right? And we believe, so our working premise is that we are unbiased receivers of sense input, and that sense input reveals a world that exists out there truly independent of my perception. And then my whole goal, if I'm going to really know the world truly, is just to get an unbiased, uncluttered view, as accurate as possible, of a world that truly exists out there. So that view is called simple-minded realism or naive realism. That is the world of classical Newtonian mechanics. And nobody has believed that in physics for, you know, over 100 years now. But we still believe that in the mind sciences. So weird. And some of the other sciences also. It's very few people in the science, because scientific education is so, and technical education is so siloized, if that's a word. they're deep and narrow, the specialties are. And so very few people, and you know, I take this from Alan and all his cohort of people that he hangs out with, very few people in the mind sciences know about quantum mechanics. You know, they're 100 years behind the times in their scientific education, which is the king of sciences that all of the other sciences in the hierarchy of sciences all derive because of, you know, Alan's explanation is because of an accidents of science in science history. But, so chemistry is all based on physics, basically, you know, and mind science is based on chemistry and neuroscience based on chemistry, et cetera, et cetera. So all is mind, with that caveat, yes, there is an external world but that operates by causes and conditions. But what is this appearance to me, and what can I know of this external world other than appearance to the mind? Interesting, isn't it? So this appearance, that's what I have to work with phenomenologically. This appearance, does that exist in the external world, or is that my own affair? That doesn't mean that there's not something, natural causes and conditions, producing something out there that I am labeling with this projection of a thing. But my thing is different. You look at the same array of parts out there, and people see different things in it. You know, it's a different thing for different people. The Coke bottle is a rolling pin for the Kalahari Bushmen, you know. So all is mind, mind is emptiness, or mind is emptiness, yeah. Emptiness is Dharmakaya, or Dharmakaya is emptiness, yeah. And then spontaneous, and then it should be probably here, emptiness is spontaneous actualization. So that's the point that is intended in Wangchuk Dorje, is that emptiness is not just a nothingness or a void, but that this, or a simple, or a sheer absence, but this emptiness is spontaneous actualization. And then spontaneous actualization is self-release. Will there be recordings? Any chance of a group picture? Craig says yes. Wow, what a sourpuss. You must have an image of yourself 30 years ago as Craig DeLarn in your... I sympathize with you. You know, I haven't had a good picture of me for 30 years either. So, we can easily have a group picture. Somebody must have a camera, right? Somebody have a camera? Yeah, everyone's got an iPhone. Yeah. So we can definitely get a picture. And then recordings will be available. And so Rick and I were just chatting about that. And you're in luck because people at Tosam Leng are waiting for recordings. People from a year ago at Salt Spring Island are still waiting for the second half of that month. But I've gotten too busy to clean them up and edit them. But Rick has volunteered to clean up and, you know, basically just clean up the stuff, take out all of my coughs and mistakes. So he's gonna fact check everything. And then Rick is really busy also right now, but he's gonna work on this in his spare time, he said. And so who knows when it will be ready, but when it is ready, you will get a notice from What Do You Think, Inc., right?
And people will be dashing all our projects between now and April.
Yeah, that's right.
Including people who weren't able to make it.
What?
Like Eric.
Oh, sure, yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, Eric and Mark also. So people that were able to, you know, that registered for the retreat, had the intention to come to the retreat, and then just circumstances prevented them. It seems like, yeah, they would really appreciate that. Can you repeat everything from the last meditation today? Yeah, that's what the recording's for. What was the last meditation? So the last meditation was Yangtang Rinpoche. So that is in the handout, so that's an easy one. So I can say yes to that. And we anticipated your request and put it in the handout. So I thought you might really be interested, like I was. You know, when Padmasambhava left Tibet after however many years he was there, because if we had another night, I would read to you actually a bedtime story from White Lama that is basically excerpting all of the Padmasambhava story into an account, and, you know, and of his years in Tibet and what he was doing there and all of that and his significance, all of that. But when Padmasambhava left Tibet, and there's, you know, great variation on the number of years that he was there, it was because he got an emergency text message that said that the cannibals, the Raksha cannibals, were massing in the southern continent, and they were going to invade and eat all of human beings for their flesh. And so he, you know, had to leave Tibet. And so, because he had achieved great transference rainbow body, he was able to dematerialize his body on the spot. And so he mounted a sunbeam. This is in Yeshe Sogyal's biography of him, The Lotus Born. He mounted a sunbeam and disappeared, left Tibet. And where he went then, after he took care of those Raksha cannibals, was back home to the glorious copper-colored mountain. So this is where Padmasambhava lives. And you hear references to glorious copper-colored mountain, but I have never known anybody who's actually visited it. So here's somebody who actually visited glorious copper-colored mountain and wrote a very detailed account of of his experience there. So, how old is he here? in the year I turned 32, okay, so he was, believe it or not, this guy was a late bloomer. Even though it started, you know, before his rebirth. In this life, he was, you read this account in his attracting students and all of that. All of the Dakinis told him it was going to happen later in his life, and it did. You know, all of his success as a teacher came later in his life. So he's 32 years old now. At night on the seventh day of the middle spring month, a bright blue woman appeared, naked, without attire or ornaments, saying she was Dakini Dorje Chanmo, Vajra wife. She asked, "My child, do you want to go and see glorious copper-colored mountain on Tail Fan Island?" I said I did. She held me by the fingers of my right hand, and we went to a place where I saw an immense black mountain peak rising to the mid-heavens. As soon as we reached its summit, the Dakini said, "My child, stretch your arms into the realm of space and draw out your body's strength. Take that stance because your dream body is intrinsically non-existent. You will fly unhindered." I did what she told me and soared through space like the king of birds. I traversed 165 greater continents and crossed over 17 oceans. When I finally reached the far shore, the Dakini told me, "This is called Lower Lanka, a continent where ogres eat humans as food. There are 18 Lanka regions across this great ocean. We've reached the border of a series of these outlying oceans." "Where is glorious copper-colored mountain?" I asked. "It's quite close." And so I'm excerpting some of this. There's, I'm going to be kind of skipping through some of the pages, but it all kind of edits into a coherent travelogue. "Then we traveled a short time, and I saw a colossal mountain, blue at the base, white in the middle, red at the top. Immediately I asked, 'What's that peak over there?' 'It's called Glorious Copper-Colored Mountain.' When we reached the hillside and looked at it from a facing mountain surrounded by a huge ocean, I saw on Copper-Colored Mountain's right slope a dense billowing cloud of rainbows. In that expanse, no one's body was visible, but I saw 88 persons from the neck up. Their heads were either covered by a scholar's hat, hair drawn up in a top knot, or various other headdresses. They smiled and gazed at me with entirely loving expressions. Since I didn't know them, I asked the Dakini, 'Who are those people over there?' 'You are being watched by the 80 great accomplished masters and the 8 supreme awareness holders.'" I just skipped over about 10 pages. "The landscape was immeasurable, and within it loomed a celestial palace made of 5 kinds of gems, perfect in all its attributes. Inside, throngs of spiritual heroes and Dakinis danced. Countless offering goddesses continuously sent forth ocean clouds of offerings. At the center, in the midst of a sea of awareness holders and accomplished adepts, stood a wide and high throne made of various jewels, upon which sat Supreme Orgyen Pema Jungne, Lotus-born. You could gaze at his face and body forever and never be satisfied. Garab Dorji was on his right, Vimala Mitra on his left, King Trisong Dutsen, the 25 subjects, and others were in front. All the awareness holders and accomplished adepts of India and Tibet were present there, inconceivable in number. Immersed in such inconceivable pure visions, I offered prostrations at the feet of Supreme Orgyen, then touched them to my head. Glorious Orgyen, Buddhist King, heed me, hold me with your compassion, I pray. Confer empowerments upon me, I pray. Grant me blessings, I pray. Give me prophecies, I pray. He then placed his hands upon my head, saying, my child, may you fully attain the supreme holy empowerments that bring maturation. May you fully attain the blessings and sacred spiritual accomplishments of the body, speech, mind, qualities, and activities of the victors of the three times with their spiritual heirs. May your ordinary body, speech, and mind shift to become the displays of the three Vajras, enlightened body, speech, and mind. And once you reach spiritual maturity and are liberated, may you gain mastery as a Buddhist king of the three realms. May any connection with you have the power to bring beings to the paths and stages of liberation. Now, sit here and listen well. These days where we've arrived at an evil era when the five forms of degeneration are rampant. Therefore, teach the innermost essence of the sacred pith instructions to individuals connected to you through their aspirations and karma, and give all the empowerments and transmissions of the profound teachings in their entirety. To establish the basis of your spiritual practice, come to a conclusion having penetrated the depths of the view of cutting through. As the path, fully understand the meaning of the key instructions of direct crossing and all of the qualities of the signs of progress along that path. Teach the sacred instructions that directly pinion negative circumstances and cut through them according to the profound practice of dispelling hindrances through severance of evil forces, which is related to the path of the Great Approach. Severance constitutes the pith instructions for considering bad omens as your own good fortune and accepting the upheavals of sickness as the path. It is especially profound. In the past, people knew the full import of these vital instructions, but no one today does. These days, the decline of the secret mantra's supreme approach is entirely due to the weakness of sentient beings' positive karma and merit. Their teachers delight in, consider best, and teach to others the paths of lesser spiritual approaches in which the concepts of the rational, intellectual mind are valued with attachment. Disciples with little merit meet only such teachers. Therefore, I will reveal to you the profound instructions or the profound teachings of great perfection, the excellent path to enlightenment in one lifetime. He then proclaimed the great tantra of supreme mystery, self-liberation of dualistic fixation. I'm interested in that one. Like a scriptural transmission, it was as if a precise copy of this clear and stable appeared in my mind stream. Guru Rinpoche told me, cultivate your experience of the superb path of great perfection, the swift path to manifest enlightenment in this lifetime. Teach it correctly to others. After he had spoken, I asked once again, universal embodiment of all victors and their heirs, precious Lord, refuge of all beings, I beseech you, reveal to me what will be the state of the doctrine and beings during my lifetime. Supreme Orgyen said, child of my spiritual family, these days we've arrived at an evil era of degeneration. The status of demons with corrupt aspirations has been elevated to prominence. Under the sway of that outlook, there is little that's good and much that's wrong. In this first part of your life, major disasters won't occur in your area. During the latter part of your life, due to the incursion of border people's power substances and incantations, irreversible or irresolvable calamities, disease, war, and famine will spread, fear and turmoil will erupt. Nevertheless, until your life ends, the doctrine of sutra and mantra definitely won't be lost to demons on a corrupt path. Interesting. During your lifetime, 1904, he died. The start of the Great Decline. But later, after some time, not even a spark of the doctrine of sutra and mantra will remain in your region. Demonic creeds will spread, and there won't be even a sesame seed's worth of a chance for happiness. During the latter part of your life, your gathering of disciples will grow, and likewise your doctrine will increase and flourish. I sent you into the world as executor of my activity, so that my remaining disciples, many karmically destined individuals, can reach the state of freedom in this lifetime. Remember this and do as much as you can to help others. Carry this out without woe and weariness. Then the Dakini from earlier said, "Now we'll go." As I prepared to leave, she intoned, "Kye ho, fortunate child of the lineage. In the false outlines of this dreamscape's appearances, there is no such thing as either going or staying. Appearances change right where they are. Focus on basic space and awaken into basic space. Do you understand?" She then dissolved into me. I turned my attention to the basic space of awareness, then woke up. So, Padmasambhava sent him in as his envoy with a mission to connect to all of us in this room. That's the way I read it. No, he never did. It's apocryphal. It's one of those urban, it's a Dharma legend. I checked this out exhaustively because it's one of, now you've opened a can of worms. But you see this all over the place, and even Lama Surya Das uses it as an epigram opening his book. And so you see it in authoritative places, and I checked this out in a number of different sources that were trying to find it also, and there is absolutely no citation ever that there's any terma revealed up to the present time where Padmasambhava is, that is attributed to Padmasambhava. And so the prophecy is that when the iron rooster flies or something like that, or the iron eagle, the iron rooster and all of that stuff, then the red men of the West will something. Yeah. You know, and it's taken as a prophecy that, you know, the time of the West was coming and all of that. But as far as research, the best research indicates that is entirely apocryphal, but very widely repeated. It's not quite time to dedicate the entire merit of the entire retreat, but today, what an extraordinary mass of merit you have created with your intense devotion to and inspiration, motivation to achieve samadhi, but not only samadhi, the insight that cuts through the remaining reification so that you actually contact, you reside in, you dwell in pristine awareness. So because of this great mass of good fortune that you have created, may it ripen not as only some temporary pleasure, but may it ripen as the greatest benefit for the greatest number of beings, so that all beings achieve samadhi, achieve the vipassana that cuts through, and reside in the pristine awareness, the three bodies of a Buddha that are their indwelling Buddha nature, and suffering disappears from the world for all time. May it be so by the goodness of what you have done today. Soha.